Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Now, you're welcome to Screen Time. I have a strange tingle in my voice this week because it's one of those special shows where we're looking at the best movie twists of all time. Yes, as it's the August bank holiday, I thought we'd do something a little different. We're looking at those best moments in cinema where you go, oh my gosh, I didn't see that coming. Or maybe you did because you're one of those clever listeners, of which we have many, to this show. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Aoife Barry, freelance journalist and author, and also Chris Wasser, film critic and movie buff and arts journalist. And he's a lot of monikers. I run out of them. If you want to join the conversation, you can tweet me John_Fardy, or you can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Good weekend to you folks.
And you, John.
Weekend.
Movie twist, right? I don't know how you feel about this, but there's a lot of bad ones. We're only going to talk about the good ones.
But good ones.
It's very annoying, a movie twist, often, if it's bad, because you feel like you've wasted your time. Do we concur? I'm putting words in your mouth, but that's that's what I think.
Yeah, I feel like you want to feel like you're genuinely surprised, but in a way that you feel like you've been duped, but you're glad you've been duped, because then you get to go back and add up all of the little signs that they've given you. I feel like that's always a good twist, as opposed to like, that is unbelievable and it makes no narrative sense and there's been no... like red, I was going to say red herrings, but maybe red herrings and clues. I don't know. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think, you know, when a twist has worked, when you can't wait to go back and watch the film for the second time to try and spot the clues. Yeah. I quite like having the rogue pull from under me, but I think it needs to be, you need to earn the twist.
Yes.
You can't just decide at the last minute, I'm going to deceive the audience here. You have to work hard for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And your way of putting it is very good. You're glad to be duped, you know?
Yeah.
Unlike an emotional relationship.
Yeah, unlike usually in life, you do not want to be duped.
I was just going to say that.
And if you're writing a story generally, like, you know, the stories we used to write for school, you know, and I woke up and it was all a dream, like, that's not going to work for most things, right?
How to
unless
get out
you're
of your
really
leaving
clever director or writer.
So. Yeah, exactly. So no Bobby in the shower, none of those analogies or whatever. Okay, so that's what we're talking about on this week's show, the best movie twists of all time. Exhibit one from Aoife Barry is this.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. Second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
The unmistakable sound of Brad Pitt giving the rules of Fight Club. Now, I should have said at the very start, the clue's in the title. There are spoilers. We are going to ruin these movies if you've never seen them, just to be clear. So please, no one text or email saying, oh, I didn't know Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's father. Please, I beg of you.
Wow.
So Fight Club.
The big one he just dropped there. Oh,
didn't know that.
Chris is desperately searching his phone. Aoife, Fight Club, why did you choose it?
I think it's just such an iconic film when you think of twists. And I think that it's so well done that when you, it's got that example of what Chris is talking about, where you want to go back and look at all the bits that you missed, because when you look back, there are bits, there are little kind of little tidbits, little crumbs dropped to let you know that actually, kind of like Sixth Sense, I think, which is very similar in the sense that you're talking about somebody who isn't what they think, what you think they are, and maybe they're not even what they think they are. So I think it works on that level of just being a really, really well done twist. And you get really, I think, into the two characters. So you're talking about Edward Norton, who plays a guy called the narrator, and Brad Pitt, who plays Tyler Durden. And, you know, the narrator basically meets Tyler on a plane. And they're so different from the get-go, because we already know that the narrator is an insomniac. He looks terrible. He has massive bags under his eyes. He hates the world, hates America. You know, he's kind of caught in this, you know, white collar world. And it's all about kind of consumerism and the, you know, the American psyche around the office and all this sort of stuff. So we know he's terrible. And then he gets on a plane and all of a sudden he's sitting next to, kind of out of nowhere when you look back.
Yeah.
He's sitting next to this handsome, well-dressed, you know, really cool guy who seems to know a lot about the world and is very kind of cynical and it has a strange job where he like makes soap. And the two of them are very much kind of, you feel like opposites, and then you watch the journey that they go on and you see why, you know, Edward Norton's character is so attracted to being in Tyler Durden's world, because it's so exciting and dangerous and they've all these like vicious fight clubs and his whole life is terrible and Tyler Durden's just so cool. And eventually, you know, we realize and he realizes, and because it's such a shock to him to discover that he actually kind of is Tyler Durden. He's basically created Tyler Durden. He's had a break, I suppose, in his personality, and all of a sudden it all makes sense. And it makes you think about that idea of, if I could do stuff in life, if I had permission to do things in life, I maybe wouldn't start a fight club, right? But if you had permission to do things that like society didn't want you to do, like he's done that by creating this character in his mind. And then we get all those great kind of short clips where you realize he realizes it was him and not Tyler. He wasn't watching things. He wasn't watching Tyler. He was watching himself. So I just really love how it's done. And I would say it's a film I really enjoy, but I don't like love a lot of it in that I find it very troubling, the kind of masculinity, machoism, this misogyny. I don't think Helena Bonham Carter's character is particularly amazingly drawn for a female character, but that's an ongoing issue with films like this. But yeah, but I still think it's just so, it's really well done, and you can see why it's kind of such an influential film and why it was so talked about in 1999 when it came out.
Yeah, and it is kind of problematic when you watch it now from these slightly more modern eyes, and the idea that, you know, all a man needs is to kick the shit out of another man, really, and it's going to solve all of his problems.
Mental health issues.
Yeah. But the twist is brilliant. And my memory of it, because it's been a long time since I saw it, is the character starts almost crashing, like on screen, doesn't he? Like he starts wavering. Isn't that how you start thinking something's wrong?
Point.
Or have I missed?
I went back and watched the scene actually again today, because there's people put, as we know, handily enough, little tiny clips from movies on YouTube. And I went back to watch the scene. I know he's on the phone to Marla Singer, Helena Bonham Carter's character at the time, and he just kind of flashes back and forth to these memories. And I think that possibly there's that kind of melding of the two characters. And I mean, the film was made with a lot of like new technology, you know, in terms of CGI, special effects. So that's really used to great aplomb in the film, and used really well, I think, in a way where you know that they're doing CGI, but it actually looks really good considering the era that it was made in. And it's directed by David Fincher. I don't know if I mentioned that. And so it feels really him, like, you know, it was such a massive movie for him. And it came a couple of years after The Game, which has a twist in it as well, which is also a brilliant film.
And of course, has Meatloaf with a serious pair of, are you allowed to say?
Man bosoms.
Man bosoms.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, again, another problematic thing where you're like, you know, but Meatloaf plays a guy called Bob who he meets at self-help.
Well-known anti-vaxxer, now deceased, multi-million selling rock star Meatloaf. Yep. I'm looking at you, Chris, when I say that for no discernible reason.
I was like, what?
You're like, where are you? Meatloaf? The twist actually of today's show is that it turns out Chris is Meatloaf.
I'm genuinely laughing. Chris, were you a fan, or are you a fan of Fight Club and its twist?
Yeah, I think I was probably the right age when it came out, because this would have come out when I was a teenager. I don't think, I watched it again a couple of years ago, and it wasn't as entertaining as I remember it, but maybe I was kind of thinking of the following that it now has. And it's not David Fincher's fault, and it's not Chuck Palahniuk's fault, that a lot of dudes took this film to heart, that they took it too seriously, and that they kind of looked up to it.
And I mean, there are now, and still to this day, white-collar boxing events, which in a way are traced back to this.
And that wasn't intentional, because Fincher was trying to say, no, there is a problem with guys fighting one another and trying to be more masculine than the other. We're just commenting on it. But unfortunately, like, these things get picked up the wrong way all the time. But I do think there are some great performances in it. Probably spent way too much time when I was a teenager reading up on all of the little stories about how it was made. Remember that thing going around that there's a Starbucks cup in every single frame?
Oh yeah, and there is one at the very start, definitely.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, so I was, in every frame. Wow, God.
Yeah, so I was a teenager kind of going, there's a lot of Starbucks cups in it, John.
How much did Starbucks pay them for that amazing product placement?
Again, but it's another kind of it's Fincher saying something about, you know, the way, you know, America is, you know, we can't go 5 minutes without, you know, buying something. No, it is entertaining, but I don't think it's aged all that well.
Okay. And when you rewatch it, Aoife, does the twist hold up? Like, can you see that he was imagining this all the time? I guess you can.
Yeah, I think it does hold up. I think the problem with films when they're, like, you know, out over 20 or so, 25 years ago, is that when you kind of, and they're that famous, is that you know there's a little twist that you should know, right? So you're kind of watching all the time. Like, somebody spoiled the Sixth Sense twist for me the year it came out. So when I went to see it, all I was doing is looking out for all the signs for that, right? So I think when you look at it, you're like, oh, when they first meet, they have the same briefcase, you know? So I think the twist does hold up, but I do think, and like Chris is saying too, that the gender politics of it, the representation of gender, you know, is very much of its time, even though, and at the time, it wasn't all seen as brilliant. At the time, critics did wrestle over what they thought about that aspect of it. So it's not like in 99 people were like, this is great. Yeah. There's always been that controversy.
Absolutely. But it's worthy an inclusion of our best twists in cinema, which we're looking at on this week's show. We mentioned Sixth Sense. Take a listen to this.
I see dead people.
In your dreams? Dead people, like, in graves and coffins?
Walking around like regular people.
the very famous scene where Haley Joel Osment, I couldn't remember his name there, tells Bruce Willis that he sees dead people. Chris, we were all kind of wrestling for this one, but we gave it to you. But I know you've rewatched The Sixth Sense recently.
I have, yes. And it made me think about the first time that I watched this. So this would have come out in August 1999 in America, but it was maybe around November, December by the time
we got
it.
Back when we had more of those split dates,
those gaps.
One
that
year.
Where, yeah,
well,
where, there were, where there would have been months as well for audiences to ruin the twist. And then it was around the summer of 2000 when I was allowed to watch it. I remember that, you know, that Saturday evening trip to like Extravision or Movie Magic or Chartbusters. Sometimes my dad would like come home with, you know, a film that the whole family could watch. Yeah. Sometimes he'd come home with something like The Sixth Sense, where my mom would say, Christopher's not watching that. So I remember with this one, there was an awful lot of buzz around it. The kids in my class, their parents had clearly allowed them to watch it. There was talk of a twist. Everything was spoiled for me except the details of what this twist is. There was an awful lot of talk around it, but I didn't really know what to expect. I just knew that when I finally watched it, something is going to happen in the last 5 minutes that will shock me. My mom and dad watched it and decided that the next day it was suitable for me to, rewind the tape and watch it myself. Everyone went out, and I will say I was probably 12 at the time, so I had the curtains drawn. Watching this film as a 12-year-old, it's not that freaky. Going back and watching it recently, like, there is an atmosphere about it. It is quite tense. But for a 12-year-old by himself in the house, that might as well have been The Exorcist.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
I was just glued to it. And I must say, at the time, the twist, it shocked the life out of me, because I was going back to that thing of, you know, you have to earn these kind of, you know, rug pulls. It really does.
Yeah.
I just did not see it coming. I thought, you know, Bruce Willis's character at the end is going to go home and talk to his wife on the advice of Haley Joel Osment. He's going to talk to her while she's asleep, and they're finally going to sort something out. Yeah. I didn't expect him to realize, oh my God, I've been dead all along.
Yeah.
Because for the uninitiated, and there are very few, I'm sure, it's about a child psychologist, Bruce Willis, who is attacked in his home at the beginning of the film, but we understand that he must have made some sort of recovery, because 9 months later, he is working with his latest patient, a 9-year-old kid, Cole Sear, played by Haley Joel Osment. He reminds him of the man that attacked him, that's Bruce Willis's character, in his home, and he's determined not to fail this patient as he thinks he failed the other one. But halfway through the film, this kid who he thinks, the psychologist thinks, is just, you know, another troubled youngster who has no friends and is having a hard time at school, it's worse than that. He actually sees dead people. And of course, the psychologist doesn't know that he's been dead all along. So I went back and watched this recently, and I thought, I'm going to try and spot the moment where, you know, M. Night Shyamalan, the first time horror filmmaker at the time, is telling us this character's dead. There has to be a moment in there. I mean, Shyamalan at one stage said that he thought it was going to be spoiled for audiences during that scene that you heard there, where the camera pans into Willis's character, and you think, and Shyamalan thought, oh, I've shown too much. Yeah. They're going to get it. I didn't get it. There's nothing in it, John. That lets you know that this twist is coming. I think it's probably, I don't think he's ever been as good. Unbreakable is, you know, pretty close, but I don't think Shyamalan has ever been as good as he is here. The storytelling is great. The mood, the atmosphere matches up with the storytelling, because it's kind of gone a little too, you know, the other way over the last few years. It's all about, like, for Shyamalan, you know, making a scene look kind of cool, but the characters are talking nonsense to one another.
Yeah.
The performances here are brilliant. The score, it is Shyamalan at the top of his game.
Yeah, and it's incredible. If we were doing a show about, you know, best first features, like, what a way to start your movie career. Are you a fan, Aoife?
Yeah, it's such a great film. Now, I haven't seen it since I think I saw it the first time. So it's been a long time. And yet it's really struck with me, I suppose, because at the time too, there was so much discussion around it, because back in the 90s, you didn't have the intense, like, constant conversations about new things. So it really was such a moment, like, in cinema. And I even though I got the twist spoiled for me, I still really loved it. And I still actually can remember scenes. There's a scene in the car with Toni Collette, the mom, and stuff like that I can still remember. It's brilliant. And I think it does make you look at M. Night Shyamalan's career, as Chris was saying, how it went later, and looking at films like Old, which is just really terrible, and a film like It's the Village, isn't it, the one that's amazing, I think another really, really good one. Some people really hate that film. I thought it was great.
There's a good twist in
there's a really good twist in that. I might save that for the end of the show, but I agree with you. Great film. It had everybody talking. It was an unbelievable first feature. And it's kind of maybe a pity that he didn't quite reach the exact same heights as that, but iconic for a reason.
And Unbreakable is very good. But, you know, I watched clips of it again today. I didn't rewatch it all. You forget two things, or I had forgotten two things. Haley Joel Osment, he's so wonder, this sounds like a weird thing to say, but he's troubled. He carries that so well for such a young boy. He looks so disturbed.
His brow all knitted.
Oh, yeah. And Bruce Willis, he's never been finer. I mean, I can take some or leave some of Bruce Willis, but he's incredible in this.
He really is. He's terrific here. And he was the only actor left out of the award season chatter because Toni Collette and Hayley Joel Osment, they were nominated for Oscars at the time. But it is quite funny that Bruce Willis only made The Sixth Sense because he had to. At the time, he was making a romantic comedy with Maura Tierney called Broadway Brawler that he was actually producing under Disney. Disney were paying for it, but he was a producer. About 3 or 4 weeks into the shoot, Bruce Willis decided that this wasn't really working out for him, the crew and the cast that he had. He sacked half the crew. They had already spent about $30 million on the film at this stage.
No.
So Disney went ballistic. They thought, we have this unfinished film that's not going to be finished because we can't afford to put any more money in. And fortunately, they were actually going to sue Bruce Willis, but fortunately his agent stepped in and said, listen, he will make three films for you at a reduced rate over the next year and a half. Those three films were Armageddon, The Kid, and The Sixth Sense.
I know what one tops the poll there. That's a great, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
actually.
There you go.
There you go. That's why we pay these people the big bucks. Now, time is running against us and it gives me less time to talk, but no crime in that. But for my first choice of the best twist, I've gone for this.
Underground. Nobody's ever seen him since. He becomes a myth, a spook story that criminals tell their kids at night. Rat on your pop and Kaiser Soze will get you. And no one ever really believes.
Do you believe in him, Verbal?
Keaton always said, I don't believe in God, but I'm afraid of him. Well, I believe in God, and the only thing that scares me is Kaiser Soze.
That was, of course, Kevin Spacey playing, well, playing a few people in The Usual Suspect. Here's the thing, guys, you know, Kevin Spacey, a problematic character, cancelled in many circles. I'm going to stick with this movie, though, The Usual Suspects, because I still think it has one of the greatest twists of all time. I rewatched it this week purposefully. The plot, I'm not sure, still holds together. In case people don't remember, these five criminals are brought together on kind of trumped up charges about a missing truck in Queens. Then they are sent to work on kind of a drug deal for a ludicrously almost urban myth criminal called Kaiser Soze, who we don't think exists. Turns out he probably does. All along in this ever-growing intricate plot, we find out that Kevin Spacey was actually Kaiser Soze. Two things came to me when I watched it. I'm not sure if the plot all holds together when you rewatch it, or I certainly couldn't understand it all. But at no point in it is Kevin Spacey's character as Klimt or Kaiser Soze in opposition to each other. So he could actually be Kaiser Soze. When you rewatch it, and I think this is only the only time I ever rewatched it, it still holds up in terms of not revealing that he was actually Kaiser Soze all along. I remember watching this on my J1 in 1995. We'd been taken to the cinema by an Italian-American chef in the country club we worked in. It was 10 minutes from the ending and he whispered in my ear, it's him. I was like, what are you talking about? No, it's not him. In case you don't know, Chuck Palmazzari drops his coffee cup, realizes Kevin Spacey has been lying to him all along, and the stuff he's been saying to him in the interview room includes all these things on a notice board. He drops his coffee cup. We see him get into a car. The limp and the, I guess, disability he's had all along disappear, and we're left thinking he is actually Kaiser Soze. It still stands up, folks, as a brilliant cinematic twist, and I really enjoyed the movie when I watched it again this week. Thoughts?
Yeah, I actually have. I didn't see this at the time, and it was always one of those classics I really want to see, and so I saw it quite late, and I think maybe I missed out on some of the fun of it because I wasn't watching it back in the 90s, but it's still like, it's a great film, and I think Kevin Spacey, you know, who is a guy who's very controversial.
Yes.
He really does excel as like weird characters that they have slightly normal edge to them, but he really, there's something going on behind the eyes the whole time. Yeah. So, you know, he doesn't always play the most trustable person, yet there's always a vulnerability about it. And I suppose with the fake disability, that kind of maybe he was trying to take advantage of people thinking that he was vulnerable in some way. So, yeah, I actually must rewatch because it's been a good while since that, I've seen it.
And Gabriel Byrne is in terrific form, as is everybody in it. Chris, 30 seconds.
No, I was thinking, what a pair, Bryan Singer and Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
I think it is perfect. I think it is okay to say that Kevin Spacey is not a great human, but he's a great actor.
Yeah.
And he was fabulous in this. And that twist does hold up. It's an awful lot of fun. You know what I've always wanted to know, John? When Dave drops his coffee cup, how come the guy at his desk next to him isn't like, you just spilled coffee all over? That always annoyed me, that he just spilled it, smashed everything and just ran out of the room, leaving a mess behind him.
And of course, that's a good point. Pete Postlethwaite was brilliant in it. He was Kobayashi, the lawyer.
Yes,
he was very small part in it, but he was now deceased, but brilliant in it. And there's a brilliant execution scene, if that's not a strange thing to say, going up in a lift involving him. Not that he's executed. Someone behind him is. That is my entry in the best cinema twist of all time. You're listening to a special Screen Time. After the break, we will continue our chat of the best movie twists of all time. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time. We're doing a special show this week where we're looking at the best movie twists of all time. I'm joined in studio by Aoife Barry and regular reviewer on this show, Chris Wasser. Aoife, back to you. And the very confusing but entertaining Memento.
I'm not going to attempt to describe the plot of this.
Tell us the whole plot.
Because I just can't. And I still, to this day, I'm like, is that what I think happened at the end? But I think that's the joy of this film. Because it's directed by Christopher Nolan, came out in 2000. I mean, what a wonderful period when you think about it. Like, and pre-social media, pre-9/11, the late 90s, early 2000s.
It sounds like you're hankering for that time, Aoife.
Maybe part of me wants to go back to simple days and I wasn't on Instagram all the time. but anyway, I digress. So Christopher Nolan, as we know from day one, has always been someone who's really been into telling stories in an interesting way and creating narrative in an interesting way. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, like with Tenet, you know, that can get very confusing or you can leave feeling like, I have no idea what happened. Yeah. I was entertained, but your luck. But for me, Memento, like, it always stuck with me because I just loved it so much the first time I saw it back in the day. And I just, you know, I think at the time I was like, oh my God, you can do this. Look at what he's done. Which is because he has two kind of narratives running through that intersect in the film. And one of them is like a present day story. And that is told in black and white. And it features Guy Pearce, who I would have known from Neighbours back in the day.
Do you think Guy Pearce is ever mentioned and Neighbours isn't
No, the poor lad. Yeah. No, unfortunately not, I don't think. But, you know, you just want to remind people of his soap past. And he's sitting in a motel room and he's telling the story about this guy called Sammy Jankus on the phone to somebody. And so you have that happening and you're learning more about him and his situation, his life through that. And then next to that is a colour, a story told in colour that is backwards. So every scene that you see actually happened before the last one that you saw. So it's like backwards and forwards at the same time. And you are trying to figure out what's happening. And so is he, because basically his character, Leonard, is an insurance salesman who has retrograde anterograde amnesia, which means he can't remember. Basically, he can't retain his memories. Mm. And he tries to deal with that by tattooing stuff on himself, by taking Polaroids, because this is pre-smartphone, and writing notes to himself too. And so as he's trying to piece together what happened to his wife, because we were told by him she's been murdered, and he's trying to track down the guy who did it, we're figuring out as he does what exactly happened, and then we're following all his tattoos and how he got them, and we meet other characters like Carrie-Anne Moss from The Matrix as well too, and we're second-guessing everybody in this film. And by the end, it seems that he has already killed the person who killed his wife, but he might also have had a role in killing his wife himself accidentally, and he might really be Sammy Jankus, and that he decides to kind of fool himself to go back and kind of take revenge on people who are taking advantage of him. It turns out he's been taken advantage of, his amnesia has been taken advantage of the whole time. So that sounds really confusing, and it is kind of confusing, but it's so enjoyable to watch. Like, it's such a workout for the brain. It looks incredible. Guy Pearce is like really thin and wiry and nervy, and you're with him the whole time. I think you really empathize with him, even though by the end you're like, oh, he kind of fooled me and he's fooling himself. And you feel sorry for him. And I think that's really key with it. And I think it's just such a clever film.
The achievement of it, you're completely right, is that it's so complicated, but yet at no point are you not with it. Because Tenet, and we won't go down a rabbit hole, but I was just irritated by that film.
Yeah.
And it came at a time when we were all praying for cinema to come back into the world because of COVID. And it was just, anyway, let's not get into that. But this is an example of, you can make a complicated movie and bring an audience with you. It's just superb filmmaking. It might be my favorite movie of his. Chris, do you enjoy Memento? Oh,
I love it. Yeah. No, I've lost count of the number of times I've watched it.
Okay.
I think Chris Nolan, that is, He works very well with his brother Jonathan because was that a short story by Jonathan?
He wrote the story for this, and then I think later wrote the short story based on it. But essentially, he did write the short story and he wrote the script. And the short story is called Memento Mori. So they are a great team in terms of ideas, story, and everything like that. Yeah,
I think they brought the best out in each other there. Although unfortunately, because that story was so popular, it led to things like Tenet, but that was just Nolan flying too close to the sun. But with Memento, he did very well. There's a discipline and an urgency in the storytelling that you don't get in Tenet. If you've never watched Nolan explain how the Memento timeline works with a marker and a whiteboard, look that up on YouTube now. It's quite soothing, actually.
Oh, I love it. I'd follow him to the end of the earth. I feel like, he'd sort out things if there is an apocalypse.
He's just
a very smart guy. He'd be, miles ahead of you.
You'd want him there at the end of the pier. Yeah. Really would. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you're listening to a special Screen Time where we're looking at the best movie twists of all time. Chris, I know this looms large in your cinematic universe. We are going to the original, as in the 1968 Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it seems like every film I'm going to be talking about today starts with a story about my parents showing it to me.
That's okay.
But I watched the original Planet of the Apes with my dad and my brother. And again, it was that thing where my dad sat there half watching the screen, half watching me and saying, wait and you see what happens. Wait and you see what happens at the end. So you're sitting there anxious going, well, I'm entertained, but I'm also like, Dad, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? But still, nothing can prepare you for when you see the top of the Statue of Liberty. And I'm like, oh, you fooled me. And again, it's that thing, like, obviously, millions of people have watched this. If you haven't, in the original Planet of the Apes, it's not like, the reboot series at all, which I have an awful lot of time for.
Some of them are very good. Yeah.
I think they've done a phenomenal job with it. That idea of, a pandemic and a lab experiment being responsible for, the rise of the Planet of the Apes. And this, the actual Planet of the Apes is explained in the sequels, but in this, the story follows a group of astronauts. Essentially, they went off on an exploration and they land on a planet and they find that this planet is run by apes. I think in the original novel, the ape civilization was far more technologically advanced, but the filmmakers and obviously the studio behind it, they were like, well, we haven't got the money. I think Rod Serling actually adapted the novel at first and he still gets a screenwriting credit, but his original script was, look, they have these vast cities and wealth and the studio took one look at it and said, we can't pay for the special effects there. That's going to be too much. So they're going to be a very basic civilization. But I think that actually works really well. I thought Charlton Heston was like totally committed to this because on paper, it seems quite ridiculous. Charlton Heston is going to be a prisoner for the apes who basically just spend the entire time trying to either castrate or kill him. That is, it just sounds horrendous and it sounds so silly, but it actually works. And then we're leading up, there's a romance along the way. There's an awful lot of violence and there's a trial. And eventually we lead up to this big reveal where Taylor, that's Charlton Heston's character, realizes that he's not a million miles away from home. He is, in fact, in the future in his home, and that due to some sort of nuclear holocaust, we have blown ourselves up. So that last shot of Heston on the beach, pounding the sand and saying, damn you all to hell, that is just, it's an incredible ending. It actually baffles me that they put that ending on the video cases and on the DVD set. Yeah,
we're talking about the head of the Statue of Liberty on the beach.
Yeah.
And that's how he twigs. And he's going, you did it, you did it. And
damn you all to hell, yeah.
Damn you all to hell, yeah. Well, funny you talk about your parents. I remember, I'd say I was five, and we watched it on TV, and I must have come in on it or whatever, and my mother explaining it to me what it meant, as in, it means they were on Earth all along. I was blown away by it. So I salute your choice.
Thank you. You don't often say that.
No, I don't. That's true.
I'll give it this time.
Aoife, have you seen it? Do you remember watching it?
Yeah, I didn't see it as a child. I think actually I saw clips of it before I saw the full thing. The clips of the very long period where they're in the kind of ape jail. I remember seeing that before I saw the full film. It is very simply done in many ways, isn't it? It's shot in the Grand Canyon Grand Canyon and California. The beach scenes, I think, are done in California. And so it looks really beautiful. And it's kind of funny in a way, you're like, obviously that's America, but you're also looking at it being like, wow, if you did land on another planet, it looks exactly like our idea of what another planet, like what Mars might look like. And Charlton Heston is great in it because he is a very cynical guy, and by the end you realise he actually really loved Earth, and he's really like, it's kind of his cynicism has been borne out that the humans destroyed themselves. I did think though the female character, is it Nova who he ends up, the woman who can't talk, like, and isn't she at the start, it's like an introducing being that actress, but like all she does is just stare at him adoringly and before riding off into the sunset. So I thought that was quite 1968 the film. Yes. But yeah, no, it's such a great film. I haven't seen a lot of the sequels though, but yeah.
Some of them are very successful.
They are, yeah. Yeah, the original sequels.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they were fun.
And the most recent one, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, was that the most recent one by Wes Ball? That was actually very good.
Yeah, the clunkiest title ever.
Yeah, I know.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. So, we are looking at the best movie twists of all time. Chris has nominated Planet of the Apes, where Charlton Heston sees the Statue of Liberty's head on the beach and realizes it was Earth all along. It is a great twist. Now, for my choice in this part of the show, I'm going with this.
What the fella said, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock.
Now, that may be the wrong clip, because that's really giving the spoiler of the movie, but that was Orson Welles in Austria bemoaning the Swiss. Now, we have to be careful here. I'm talking about The Third Man, because I could talk and talk about this. This is one of my favourite movies of all time, set in Vienna right after World War II, which is a crossroads city. And Vienna was always a crossroads city, even before the war, like between the Holy Roman Empire and the Ottoman. I'm going down a rabbit hole. I better stop. What takes place in this divided city of Vienna is a guy called Holly Kearns comes to Vienna, and he's an author, kind of pulp fiction novels, and he's going to give a talk. And it turns out his old school friend is living in Vienna as well, called Harry Lime, and he's been murdered supposedly. And they want to know who the third man was who carried the body, because this will give a clue to who murdered Harry. And then so far so good. We have this kind of espionage, black and white, great music, that sitar, gang, 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 in this divided city of Europe. And you think it's going to be one kind of thing. And then you realize that the guy they're going in search of, who they thought was dead, Harry, is alive. He's played by Orson Welles. And it's the scene. It's one of the greatest moments in cinema history. Yes, I said it, where we're in some side street in Vienna and a light shines on Orson Welles' face. And you go, he's alive. And then we see him in that scene we heard on top of a fairground ride, talking about the Swiss and talking about this horrible thing he's involved in, where he's in essence killing people for money. And the twist of seeing Orson Welles again, I was a child, seeing his face for the first time. It's one of the greatest movie twists, and it's an hour into a movie, and it turns this movie into something completely different. It's one of the most successful twists. It's one of the most successful movies of all time. What I will say is, don't do the Third Man tour in Vienna.
Oh.
Because you walk around these lovely streets of Vienna and they go, yeah, that was shot in Pinewood Studios in London. Yeah, that was shot in Cornwall. I mean, there are a few bits, but I was deeply underwhelmed by
that's
it, I have
very
to say.
Disappointing.
Because I was very excited about seeing it. Are you fans? I mean, you're probably afraid to say you're not, but...
Oh, no, I think we were both late to the film, shall we say. It's that thing of this iconic movie that you're like, oh, yeah, I have to get around to watching that. And then when you finally do, you're like, oh, my God. I think the way, like, it has all those Dutch angles in it. So the way it's shot is so cool. And the fact that the language in it is between, like, German and English, you're confused the whole time. Like, you're disorientated because of the angles that it's framed at. And then you're disorientated because it's not telling you what people are saying. And I know a tiny bit of German, so I could, like, pick out words here and there. But if you don't know German, you're really confused. So that sense of confusion replicates the confusion that runs through the film.
Yeah.
And that amazing scene, which I think everybody's probably seen clips of, that you're talking about, when Orson Welles is running and the huge shadows are against the wall. Like, oh my God, that's just like a feast of the eyes.
It's kind of cinema 101.
Yeah, you know? Completely. Yeah.
Chris, you're being very quiet.
I am being very quiet because I'm ashamed to say that I've never watched The Third Man. And I'm sorry to say that, because we're supposed to at least pretend that we have seen everything. But I was 30 before I watched Citizen Kane. It was a birthday gift on DVD, so maybe I'll get to The Third Man by the time I'm 40. It's a promise.
It's a good plan. It's a good plan.
Well, if you've just tuned in, we are doing a special Screen Time this week, where we're looking at the best movie twist or film twist of all time. After the break, more of our choices. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. This is a special show we're doing this week, where we're looking at the best film twists of all time. So far, we've mentioned things like The Sixth Sense, Fight Club, Memento, and of course The Usual Suspects. And I was talking about The Third Man before the break, which Chris Wasser very honestly said he'd never seen, and none of us said shame on you, Chris, at all. Oh, quite the opposite.
Not at all.
Aoife, let's get back to you. And I'm talking to, I should mention, Aoife Barry and Chris Wasser, in case that wasn't evident from those dulcet tones. Aoife, your final choice, it was kind of back in the news with the sad passing of Donald Sutherland. Didn't come to my mind straight away, but Don't Look Now.
Yeah, and I think this one isn't probably the most obvious one when you think of a twist, but I think the ending of it definitely functions as a twist because sure. you do not expect it to happen, and it makes you look back on a lot of stuff that's happened in the film up to that point. And it's just, oh my God, it's just such an amazing film. So it's from 1973, which first of all is a big tick in my book because that's a particular kind of era that I think a film just looks amazing in. Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie play parents. When we first meet them, it's like this pastor image. They're in this beautiful old country house in England. Their two kids are playing out, you know, 1970s parenting. The kids are playing by a stream and the parents are in the house. And their daughter tragically dies. She drowns in the river, in the kind of small stream or river. And we first get a sense something is off, and that kind of leads up to the twist because Donald Sutherland is looking at these film slides because he's involved with them with restoring old church windows. And there's a figure appears in a slide he's looking at. They're wearing a red jacket, rain jacket. His daughter's wearing a red rain jacket. He spills water on the slide. It's like this kind of water that looks like blood flows over the slide. And then the next thing we know, it's like he's had a premonition. He's running out of the house and he's picking his daughter's body out of the water. And so straight away, you're like, what does he know? What do we know? What's happening? And you follow that, you know, the red person in a raincoat becomes a motif, and the color red becomes a motif that repeats the whole way through the film. And he and his wife get kind of obsessed with the idea of their daughter's death when they go to Venice, and the idea of, as Julie Christie's character thinks, because of some psychic woman she met, whether their daughter is still out there for them to contact.
Yeah.
And in that quest for finding knowledge and in that kind of disorientation that they feel when they're in gloomy November or kind of wintertime Venice, Donald Sutherland ends up pursuing this person who's wearing this red raincoat that looks exactly like his daughter, and by doing that he basically meets his death. But that's foreshadowed a bit in the film by him seeing strange things like his wife on a funeral gondola going through Venice. So I just remember being so shocked when that happened at the end. It just does not feel like it that he gets killed,
yeah,
and that person is actually the strange old woman and not, as we might think, the ghost of his daughter, yeah, or really his daughter running through. It becomes something completely different and makes you really assess how like dark and creepy the film is.
It's really, you know, dark. I watched bits of it again because I was watching an interview with Mark Cousins and the now sadly passed Donald Sutherland and Nicholas Roeg, who directed it. The stuff he does in that, it's really unique. Like even the sex scene, it's such a strange, like sex scenes are often a waste of time.
You feel.
They're just trying to titillate people, whatever. But this is so different in that they're having sex and then they're not. It's just the way the whole movie hops about. It's a masterclass in uniqueness.
It really is. I think it's like, I mean, if you're a filmmaker watching this, you would learn so much about even like non-linear storytelling, because they go back and forth between flashbacks, and there's just something so slightly like weird about what's going on, like the way it's cut and like really quick cuts and then slow-mo in between the quick cuts and then all these like match cuts and all this sort of crack, and you're like, oh my God, something's happening, I'm being hypnotized by this, you know. It's just, I just love it so much.
And this sounds like a real weird place to go, but there is a movement in, you know, the Canary Islands and stuff like this where there's a certain anti-tourism. If they want to get the tourists out of Venice, show them this movie. You know, Venice, St. Mark's Squares, ice cream, pizza, Venice in the winter. And I've been to Venice in the winter, and all you think about, if you're like me, is that movie. Yeah, it's terrifying.
One of my dreams is to go to Venice in the winter. I've only been there in the summer, but because of this film, I really want to go in the winter. I'm like, I want it to be as creepy and weird.
It's a different city in the winter. There's much less tourists. It's a great place to go, but it's creepy. It really is. Those dark twilight canals. Maybe that's just our cinematic brains, but I think you would feel the same. Chris, you've seen?
I have.
I don't mean to that just because you haven't seen The Third Man.
We're going to get that question all the time there.
So you've seen Empire Strikes
Back? You've seen Star Wars, have you? Chilling. It really is. Yeah. I was probably far too young when I watched it, and it's actually interesting interesting that you mentioned that sex scene, because there's an awful lot of talk now about whether sex scenes in films are necessary.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit of a silly question, because in with something like this, that sex scene alone tells you an awful lot about their relationship, particularly around that time, which is awful for them. I thought Donald Sutherland in particular, that final scene stayed with me, haunted me.
Yeah.
And he never received, I think he had the honorary Oscar
in the last few years,
but he never had an acting nomination.
Never
an Oscar. There was never an Oscar nomination there for
like, yeah.
Absolutely.
Should
have been nominated for this.
Role, and for Ordinary People as well.
Ordinary People, yes.
Excellent. Don't Look Now, a brilliant, brilliant movie, which is one of Aoife Barry's selections for the best film twists of all time. Chris, your next one is this. The unmistakable sound of Psycho.
Yeah. It's so strange now that Alfred Hitchcock, during that murder scene, or for that murder scene, which took about a week to shoot, and I think he incorporated something like 50 shots into that scene, which barely lasts a minute, but he wanted it to be silent. He wanted the only sounds for the audience to hear was like the shower curtain coming undone, the knife going into Marion Crane, which they did by basically stabbing a watermelon. He wanted all of that to be in the audience head. He didn't want any score. And basically he just, you know, he had the composer, he had everyone around him say, no, you have to put something in here. And I'm really glad that he did.
Yes.
It was a nightmare for Alfred Hitchcock to make, but his nightmare turned into one of the best screen horrors.
And the twist.
The twist. So the twist, and this is quite funny, because if you had gone to see Psycho when it originally came out in 1960, in American picture houses at least, you would have seen a poster and a life-size cardboard cutout of Alfred Hitchcock pointing at his watch. And then, a speech bubble next to him saying, make sure you watch this film from the start. And then on the other side, no latecomers admitted. So if you bought a ticket for Psycho and you showed up to the cinema and it had already started, you weren't allowed in. And this is an awful long time before basically Marvel monetized the term spoiler. But the spoiler that, you know, the studio and that Alfred Hitchcock didn't want revealed was that Marion Crane, the film's main star, the leading woman, you know, played by Janet Leigh, she dies after the 40 minute mark. She is the victim of Norman Bates. And that is so rare for a film to kind of advertise and say, you know, here's Anthony Perkins, here's Janet Leigh, one of them is going to die after 40 minutes and then there's still an hour film. So that was the big twist, that, you know, she plays this secretary at a real estate agency who steals 40 or 50 grand from her boss because she wants to give it to her lover who has all of these debts and is trying to divorce his wife. And when she's driving to his house in California with the money in the trunk, she needs to stay somewhere overnight. She pulls up at this motel. She thinks, Bates Motel, yep, that looks safe. Anthony Perkins is the manager. He looks okay. He's not okay. And he kills her. And then what happens is we have the people in her life and her lover basically investigating her disappearance. Where is she gone? Where was she last seen? Bates Motel, let's go there. And what the murder scene I always found terrifying. Watching it again recently, watched it about a year ago, the cleanup afterwards freaked the hell out of me. It's just, it feels as though it goes on for half an hour. It's probably only about 5 minutes, but we're just watching Anthony Perkins, Norman, just tidying the bathroom, hiding all the evidence of this grisly act that he's just committed. And that was the scene that Hitchcock decided to leave silent.
Right.
It's just masterful filmmaking, great performances out of everyone, totally messing with the convention of what, you know, should happen in a mainstream horror picture. And also the proper birth of the blockbuster and of the slasher. It's a genius.
Yeah, it contains kind of multitude of influences in terms of where we are today, in terms of, we don't have much time, so... Do you like Psycho?
Yeah, and to be honest, it's been so long since I watched it. But I remember just being, really creeped out by it. And also the shower scene, being so fascinated because it's like that illusion of you seeing things you're not seeing. Yeah. And that's why it's so effectively done. And I think, it's Hitchcock. So you're always going to be really enjoying whatever he does. And the creepiness of Norman Bates and the mother and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I'm actually going to rewatch that now. But
I kind of feel like that's been a long time since I saw it as well. My final choice in this special where we're looking at the best film twists of all time is The Crying Game, which I rewatched recently in advance of my interview with Neil Jordan recently. And what I like about this film is that there is, I suppose, almost an accusation now, oh, you've chosen this, the twist, it's kind of pedestalizing freakishness and you're making out that transgender people are somehow, this is a big twist. For people who don't know, in The Crying Game, Stephen Ray plays an IRA killer who is part of a group that take Forest Whitaker's black, and that's important, British shoulder hostage. They end up, they're going to kill him. He gets hit by a British Army Jeep, ironically. Then Stephen Ray goes to London to track down what he believes was Jodie, that's Forrest Whitaker's wife or widow, as she is at this stage, or certainly partner. He enters a relationship with her. As they're about to have sex, it turns out she's transgender. He thought she was a woman. She has, I'm not sure what the, she is a she, I guess is the correct way of putting it.
Yeah, I suppose at the time, the language around it probably wasn't that well done. Yeah. I think it seems more that Neil Jordan would have used the kind of outdated phrase now, yes, transvestite, which maybe would have indicated that Jay Davidson's character wasn't transgender. But again, it probably highlights things, how much things have changed now with yeah. that, with that, of those
absolutely
kind of characters.
So she yeah. was transgender, as we would say nowadays, or is transgender, Jay Richardson. And the twist is that he didn't know this. And so you might think, oh, well, that's a bit of a very 1990s twist on things. But you see, what I think is brilliant about this movie is that it is not just a movie about sexuality. It is a movie about identity in its entirety. You have an IRA guy who turns out is very sympathetic to this black British soldier who, it turns out, his father was from Jamaica. He goes to the UK and finds his sworn enemy, finds some kind of happiness on this building site, and then in this pub when he meets what he thought was a woman who turns out to be transgender. So the whole movie, yes, the twist at the time, to our unaware eyes, was kind of shocking that it was actually a transgender person all along. But it's the identity and the twist in identity throughout this movie about no one is what they claim to be. And I think that it still holds up in that way. And the way the movie ends is, well, we can give the spoiler where they're going to be together, Jay and Stephen Ray's character. And Stephen Ray, because I rewatched it recently, he is brilliant in this. And he has these kind brown eyes. Even though he's a killer, he's going to shoot this British soldier. He can't in the end. He's just magnetic in it. He really is. Thoughts on The Crying Game?
Yeah, I think all the stuff around Jay Davidson's character, Dill, and how the gender stuff is treated in it does show in a good way how much has changed now, where yeah. you couldn't mm. use that as a reveal no. now. It would be so bad and not very well taken for really yeah. good reasons. And I think that's what kind of makes it a maybe problematic movie for some people to watch. And something that I think Neil Jordan is asked about, around how it was treated. But I think, and I do think when I rewatched it, what I thought was interesting was how, like, he attacks, but like he hits still after yeah. this revelation, yeah. which is just, again, of its time, really, really shocking.
Absolutely.
And yet Dill forgives his character, and they go on to, he kind of learns from that, as yeah. in Stephen Ray's character, learns from it and actually ends up really protective of Dill yeah. and actually cuts her hair and treats her a certain way to make sure to get her out of danger. So it does have that, like, redemption yeah. arc going on. So I think I have very complicated feelings around it. Unfortunately, but I think even leaving that stuff aside, it's such a great film. They made it for like $5 million
yeah.
dollars, and they had no money to make it. And look at what a kind of long lasting Irish film it is.
And to make it more problematic, Harvey Weinstein, who was in charge, didn't give. They were all meant to get a cut out of it, and he changed the deal, so they didn't. But let's not get into
okay.
that. But no, absolutely, it's problematic. But I suppose my point for putting it in is that I want to make the point that the twists in it aren't just about that. Mm. It's all about twisting identities, and that's why I still think yeah. it works. But the idea that it's being sold as it's a reveal, you know, she had different bits than we thought, absolutely, that's mm-hmm. problematic if the movie is sold that way, which mm-hmm. I don't think it is anymore. Chris, are you a fan of The Crying Game?
Yeah, I don't think that's the big takeaway from it either.
Yeah.
You can watch it, and that will be, you know, three or four reasons, down the list of why you might recommend
yeah.
it to people.
Yeah.
Like, oh, there's a twist in it. That's not
yeah.
really why people enjoyed it. I think Stephen Ray is probably the best
yeah.
he's been, certainly on screen in that role. And I think Neil Jordan too, whose films I haven't had an easy relationship
okay.
with, especially the couple that he would have made after The Crying Game. But I thought he was a great storyteller on that one, and almost missed accepting his Oscar the following year because he was in the bathroom. That's right. Remember that? Yeah, that, it's one of the great Irish filmmaker Oscar speeches where the filmmaker goes up on stage and says, sorry, I was in the loo. So yeah, he deserved it though.
And you know, there's a brilliant scene in it where they're going to have to basically shoot Forest Whitaker's character, and Adrian Dunbar, who's the head of the IRA, starts saying to him on behalf of the... And Stephen Ray goes, stop, stop, now's not the time. It's actually very funny in places as well. So listen, we have been talking about the best movie twists of all time, or film twists. Sorry, I'm always getting in trouble for calling them movies. That said, we do have time for maybe one or two quick honourable mentions that I didn't let you go full tilt on. But Aoife, is there a movie you're dying to mention with a great twist?
Very quickly, I think Arrival has a really good twist in it. It's one of those slightly confusing ones. Amy Adams' film about her communicating with aliens. And at the end, you're like, oh, hang on, something about her being sick. I can't even remember the twist fully, but you realise it's not that the timing isn't what you thought it was.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really good. I do like The Village, the M. Night Shyamalan one.
Yeah.
You know, about this kind of, it seems like a village from back in the day, and it turns out actually it's this community that's in real time. And then some people think that Donnie Darko has a twist, but I just wanted to mention it because I thought it kept appearing, and I was just checking, you know, what other films have twists in them. And I don't know if it has a twist, but I love that film so much that I thought, you know, I'm going to mention it.
The
ending, though, is completely bonkers, so maybe file it under bonkers, but some people consider the ending a twist.
Yeah, we may have to rewatch. Yeah. Now, Chris, I know there's one you want to mention. I second it because I mentioned it the last time we did a special because it might be the greatest movie twist of all time.
Yeah, The Empire Strikes Back, when Darth Vader tells Luke Skywalker that he's his old man and he's been missing for the last 30 years. That's a big reveal.
It is.
That is like, it's shocking if you're a 5-year-old watching it, if you're a 35-year-old, you do not see it coming. And it's so devastating. And it must have been also so weird for Star Wars fans when it was released, having to wait then another 3 years to see what happens next. Yeah. There's no online chatter. You have to kind of call people up or write to them in order to have conversations about it. It was a big one and a very enjoyable one, and it earned us. I don't know if everything that came afterwards was so clean, but if we have time, I might mention one more, The Prestige.
Another great one.
Hugh Jackman, one of the world's greatest magicians, is just can't get over how his rival has done this trick, which involves someone that looks like him. It turns out that other magician played by Christian Bale has a twin brother.
It's
such a stupid twist, but I didn't see that one coming.
It is a great twist. But just, you know, Mark Hamill, apparently he had a nightmare trying to keep that all those years, you know.
Oh yeah, I love that story where he's at the premiere with Harrison Ford, and Harrison Ford turns to him and says, hey kid, you never told me that.
How very Harrison Ford-esque. I mean, if there was time, we don't have time, we probably should mention Citizen Kane and how Rosebud was actually his beloved cart all along.
And definitely check out an episode of The Animaniacs, which is where I first came across Citizen Kane as a young person, because they do a Citizen Kane knockoff where Acne is a name that instead of Rosebud.
It's lampooned in The Simpsons, in an episode of The Sopranos. They're having a movie night and they mention it. Anyway, listen, we could do another hour on this and maybe we should. I have been delighted to be joined by film critic and arts journalist Chris Wasser and freelance journalist and indeed author Aoife Barry, who've been bringing me their favourite film twists of all time. If you'd like to get in touch and argue with us about anything we've been saying, get in touch with me. Don't bother them. You can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.